Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
You know, and then there's also this, you know, still in the relatively early stages, but this galvanizing of popular resistance. So he's definitely changing the face of Chicago in some form that will be lasting, and how that really, what that is, remains to be seen.
Coming up, we'll hear from the author of the new book, Mayor 1%, a critical look at Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. But first, here are some headlines from the Indie Media Network around the world. Argentina Indie Media featured a protest over sex education, or lack thereof, at a national education ministry. On October 4, 2013, members of a teachers' guild, as well as members of the pride group Rosario and other Pride March organizers, held a protest outside the Argentine Ministry of Education in the Argentine province of Santa Fe. Protesters objected to a new policy translated as integral sexual education, which activists deemed woefully inadequate for the needs of LGBT students and the community. The feature described it as far from a real proposal for training and service. A photo accompanying the feature showed a rainbow-colored banner outside the ministry with words translated as integral sexual education, no more. Indie Media UK reports on vigorous UK protests against the controversial oil extraction process known as fracking. Quoting from the feature in August 2013, attempts by oil developers at Quadrilla Resources to begin exploratory drilling for gas at Balcombe, West Sussex, have met with strong resistance by locals and environmental activists from around the country who have come together for a protest called the Great Gas Gala. The start of drilling has been significantly delayed in spite of excessive and repressive policing. In the first week of protests, a blockade preventing trucks from delivering drilling equipment. In the second week, police violently pushed aside a pregnant woman taking part in the blockade. The proposed drill site was less than 1 mile from the village, close to a reservoir that provided drinking water for 85,000 people in Sussex. DC Indie Media reported on arrests in the office of a noted senator against the wartime use of remote-controlled airplanes known as drones. Quoting from the feature, on the 18th of November, 26 activists against the U.S. drone killing program packed into pro-drone New York Senator Chuck Schumer's office in the Hart Senate office building, demanding he issued a statement denouncing the use of armed drones for assassinations. Senator Schumer's office was almost completely filled with anti-drone activists, to the point that more had to remain in the hallway. A letter to the senator was read out, followed by the names of those killed by U.S. drones, focusing on children. Senator Schumer's Foreign Affairs National Security staffer complained that the protesters were a fire hazard, drawing a rebuke that the drones are a worse hazard. When Capitol Police arrived, they did not demand activists leave. Instead, they insisted on closing the doors. At this point, most activists left, but three grandmothers and one man, all with considerable experience in anti-war activism, stayed behind. All four remaining activists were arrested. Portland Indie Media featured the notable anniversary of a Portland Police Justice Group. Quoting from the feature, Portland Cop Watch has been for 20 years keeping an eye, cameras, and their legal trained eye on what the Portland Police have been doing, and then sharing updates and reports in their quarterly newsletters. These People's Police Report newsletters just marked their 20th anniversary. Beside the newsletter, Portland Cop Watch is reporting, covering meetings, talking with officials, video documenting, and lobbying for police accountability. They hold trainings and teach Your Rights classes. The first 20 years of Portland Cop Watch's newsletters are available online at portlandcopwatch.org. Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you From the Trenches. In 2011, political insider, congressional representative, and former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel fought off a residency challenge and won a six-way race, becoming Chicago's first new mayor in 21 years. But Barack Obama's guy, as he was called during his mayoral campaign, ushered in controversial mental health closings and school closings and faced worldwide criticism over increasing violence in the streets. Meanwhile, political activism in Chicago has seen an upsurge in activity in recent years, arguably as a grassroots response to Rahm Emanuel's policies. Rahm Emanuel is the focus of the new book, Mayor 1%. Rahm Emanuel is the focus of the new book, Mayor 1%, Rahm Emanuel and the Rise of Chicago's 99%, by Chicago author and journalist Kari Leiterson. We'll spend the hour with Kari Leiterson, who spoke about the book, Rahm Emanuel's career, and his policies as mayor in the interview with Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stupinczyk. The following interview was recorded on Thursday, November 7th, 2013.
We are joined by Kari Leiterson. Kari Leiterson is a Chicago-based journalist who has worked with the Washington Post and with the Chicago News Cooperative, a specialist in environment, energy, labor, and immigration issues, the author of a number of books. Her most recent book, just published, Mayor 1%, Rahm Emanuel and the Rise of Chicago's 99%, published by Haymarket Books. Kari, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why did you write a book about Rahm Emanuel?
Well, it was actually the publisher's idea, Haymarket Books, and it turned out to be a great idea when they asked me, and I think it was around August or September of 2011. I thought it was interesting, but, it didn't seem like the most compelling topic in the world. And I think at the time they were thinking more like sort of a user's guide to who Rahm Emanuel is for people that didn't realize who they'd elected. So it really evolved over the time we were writing it. Sorry, long answer, but
that's okay.
Yeah, but it became, he did so many things so quickly as mayor that it ended up, I think they really had a lot of foresight in deciding to do this.
And you took the project despite your hesitancy, or
why
take up the project?
Well, right, because my hesitancy partly had to do with, I'm not necessarily a big fan of him, but, he doesn't seem that bad, and he's actually had done good things on the Great Lakes and Congress, which I was really aware of. So my hesitancy was like, aren't there better people to write a book about? And then it turned out that, he became just such a significant figure in so many ways that it turned out to be, a great idea to do a book about him.
To your knowledge, are there any other books about Rahm Emanuel? I mean, there's the book that he co-wrote, but But are there any other biographies of Rahm Emanuel? I think this is the first, as far as I know. Do you know?
I think it is. The Tribune, I think, did an ebook, like a compilation of their coverage, but that's a little different. Right. And his brother did this memoir, which, you know, talks a lot about him.
Which brother, Ari or Ezekiel?
It was Ezekiel. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, he did, most notably, Rahm Emanuel is a family of three brothers, both of whom are kind of famous in their own rights. Ari Emanuel as a famous Hollywood talent agent, and Ezekiel Emanuel, who is a medical ethicist. So that's the thing there is, this might be the first book strictly about Rahm Emanuel, at least as a kind of biography of sorts. And so that would mean that any, you know, clearly Rahm Emanuel, if he wants to write his own biography after his career is over or something, will have to probably... I don't know if, say, account for, but probably try to address a lot of the issues that you place here, and which are, at least for many people, maybe even more widely common knowledge. One thing about the book that I found peculiar is that in a lot of ways, even though the book is ostensibly about Rahm Emanuel, and you know the title and the cover all feature him, and it features his his sequence of his career, in a lot of ways it's about a lot of the Chicago activists that are featured who have opposed a lot of his policies in the now more than 2 years since he's been mayor. But it seems like that the book itself is kind of like highlighting those folks and using Rahm Emanuel as the kind of vehicle to doing that. Was that what you had in mind, or is that the effect of it, or tell me about that?
Yeah, I don't think it was what I had in mind to start with, but it just became, especially with the teacher strike and everything else, it just became, you know, in some ways an even bigger story, or a more untold story, you know, what these groups were doing and how all different Chicagoans were responding.
Mm-hmm. Did you... I first known about Rahm Emanuel, actually, he was my congressional representative before he became mayor. In fact, before becoming chief of staff in the White House, he was actually representative of Illinois' 5th District, which is where I lived, and in fact, still do live. And that's a notorious, at least as far as political history goes. It was Rod Blagojevich, before he was governor, was representative of that district, and Dan Rostenkovsky, the House Ways and Means scandal-ridden guy, was also representative from that district. That he held that same seat, and Rahm Emanuel, you know, to complete the infamous trio of people from the same political district. When he was representative, when he was in Congress, my impression about him was kind of a mixed bag. On the particular issues that I was working on and was interested in, mostly regarding media and policy, I actually found him to be okay. In fact, he would take on and vote in favor of policies that that at the time were pretty unpopular, but which he actually, to his credit, to my relief at the time, he actually did some good things. And you had talked about this a little bit. But in almost everything else, and then like everything else, even though I was kind of interested in but didn't work on it, he was... bad and worse. What do you think is his legacy with regards to his time in Congress? Do you think that it had anything to do with shaping his time in being mayor, or what's the connection there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I don't think his time in Congress, I don't think he did a lot then to really upset people. I mean, he did do good things. I wasn't even as aware of the media things, but you know, he did some good things for veterans. He did a lot of good things for the Great Lakes. He did do some, you know, just sort of consumer public protection type things. And but I guess, you know, the most notable thing was he spearheaded the takeover of the House in 2006.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
So I think that's really, you know, indicative of who he is as a politician and as a person. And one of the things that was really notable, I mean, one, he was effective, you know, he succeeded in what could have been a really big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it showcased, well, one, just his fundraising ability, which he's always been famous for. And then I think the thing that's most politically indicative is he backed a number of candidates who were pretty, for Democrats, you know, fairly right-wing, especially on social issues, which is kind of interesting since he's pretty himself, you know, pretty... I don't know what left or liberal or whatever the right word is, but, you know, he's pro-gay rights. He's fairly, especially now, strict on gun control.
Socially liberal, I guess you might call it.
Yeah, right. So he backs candidates that were pro-gun and anti-choice and pro-war. And in a lot of cases, those were candidates that were knocking out in the primary, knocking out candidates who were anti-war and who in some cases had a lot more grassroots or popular support, you know, when he came in with the Democratic Party behind him and all that money and muscle. So I think that's where you can see that he's someone who, this is no secret to either his fans or his detractors, someone who's all about power as opposed to ideals or, you know, protecting the underdog.
That actually leads me to my next question. I think that Rahm Emanuel kind of assumes, and I think still does, especially in the serving as Chicago's mayor, as he kind of embodies and thinks that money power, if not necessarily is the only power, is maybe the biggest power. If you can control the purse strings, you've got it made, and you can control practically anything that you want because you've got that. Mm-hmm. And the 2006 elections were indicative of that. But yet, I think that in some ways, when other kinds of power, particularly organized political power, most notably the Chicago Teachers Union strike, where there wasn't nearly the kind of money that was poured into it, but a tremendous amount of people power, that really, to which Rahm Emanuel couldn't respond as well and got, for lack of a better word, slapped in the face, even though it's not physically, but his reputation was besmirched. His legacy is certainly besmirched. And a lot of people will, and certainly that will, when the final history of his career is written, will certainly be a black mark on it, at least as far as he is concerned.
Yeah.
But the whole thing regarding that money power is the only power and anything else is either wrong, but when he's proven wrong, then it seems like he's, to put it bluntly, he doesn't like it. Tell me about what your thoughts are on that aspect of it. Does it kind of ring true with what you're experiencing researching about?
Oh, definitely. And just in terms of not liking when he's proved wrong, I mean, that's something that just on a personality level, you know, anecdotally, you do hear from people who are both his fans and critics, that he's just someone who can't stand to be wrong and, you know, reacts kind of defensively and impulsively when he's challenged or proved wrong, you know, even in relatively minor ways. So, you know, a lot of people have that quality, but that's something that I think has contributed to his problems as mayor, because he kind of gets his hackles up or picks a fight even when he doesn't have to. And in terms of what you said before about like money, power being defined by money versus people power, that's definitely true about his respect for money and its power, which, you know, unfortunately, he's probably in a lot of ways right about that in our political system. But I think that's part of why he was so caught off guard by the teachers, is I think he lacks a full understanding and respect for the level of, you know, power that can be marshaled by people motivated by, you know, their ideology and, you know, their struggle for justice.
The interesting thing about that is that there's a great irony about that teacher strike, and we'll be getting more into that in a moment. But I'm going to actually like to quote an excerpt from the book, page 163, referring to the teacher strike. Rahm Emanuel did not understand what he was getting into. And yet, for earlier in the book, especially where in the early parts of his career, in the early 90s when he was working in the Clinton White House, and especially in his time in Congress, that he was a master of what's called opposition research. You're the way you can defeat your opponents, usually in the political sphere, but in other ways, is you try to learn as much as you possibly can about them and use that information in various ways against them. And yet, he didn't do that in the case of the Chicago Teachers Union strike and the Chicago Teachers Union general, where you figure, you know, you're the grandmaster of this sort of stuff, and yet you kind of drop the ball on this, to mix metaphors. But that's the point here. So what accounts for the fact that he was, you know, so good at this early on and so bad on it later on? Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would love to know what he actually thought and talked about and how much research he did on the teachers' union. And if he was even, to what extent he was even aware of the, at the time, relatively new leadership of the teachers' union, CORE, the progressive faction that had taken over.
Yep, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, CORE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he obviously underestimated them, and maybe that was just a matter of him being so dismissive of labor and regular people that he just didn't think he just assumed that they weren't going to be a worthy opponent That's really the only explanation I can think of. Either that, or, you know, he just figured,
They lose because they always lose.
Maybe. I mean, which would go back to him not understanding the new leadership, because the teachers union, well, actually they didn't always lose in the past. They actually, you know, sort of beat Daly, or not beat, but got concessions from Daly in different ways in the past. But, I think, yeah, he definitely just didn't understand, you know, the way things stood when he came in.
I could understand why he might think that, if given the whole trend of what's called neoliberalism, where things like organized labor and, you know, anti-war efforts have long gotten kicked in the teeth by the systems that they're caught in. That, yeah, it's just like, oh, they're going to lose because they always lose, because, you know, in a lot of ways they're their own worst enemy, and even when they're organized, they'll have to fight against systems for which they're going to be outgunned. Mm-hmm. So maybe he just thought that way, but we may know that someday. In the wake of the CTU strike, and I don't know the connection about this, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. In the wake of the CTU strike, the Chicago public schools had announced that they were going to close, announced the largest school closings in American history, it turns out. They had earlier announced maybe as many as 200 out of 600 schools closed. The number wound up being closer to about 50. But I think that may have been what their goal was the whole along. We closed 50 schools, you know, inflated as a big number, and then reduce it when a lot of people will think, whew, he saved a lot of schools, but that was the goal all along. And part of me is absolutely convinced, although I'll never be able, or maybe never be able to get the evidence on this, that he closed those schools down as a punch in the face back to the Chicago Teachers Union. Is there any evidence on this, or am I thinking about this? I mean, there's strong suspicion about this, but you know anything about whether or not there's any
anything to this? You know, well, I mean, I think there was, like, some of the schools are obviously in trouble. Some of the schools did have really small populations, but as it ended up, you know, the closings, the logic that he was closing underutilized schools in the end didn't hold up, because, I mean, that could be a whole other conversation, but it's hard to know, but the way he went about it was obviously a big blow to the teachers union, and it did entail mass layoffs of teachers, which I'm sure was a silver lining for him, if not the main motivation.
Right.
And then also, if I'm remembering right, CPS never announced large numbers. They never announced 100 or 200. I think it was the Tribune and the Sun-Times and other analysts, based on other things the school district was saying, and based on the school district's supposed logic about underutilization, they came up with the number that over 100 schools would meet the definition for closure. But the school district was really cagey and evasive all along about how many could actually be closed, and they kept changing their story, and they would never give a clear definition. I think just because, you know, one, I think they were completely unorganized themselves. And then two, I mean, they've been characterized by a lack of transparency even before Mayor Emanuel, but that's just gotten worse since Mayor Emanuel. So, you know, they didn't want, I think their own logic was constantly changing and faulty. And then even to whatever extent they did have their own act straight, they didn't want people to be able to parse that or criticize it. So, you know, maybe it was to their benefit that the papers put out those 100 plus numbers, so that then when it came down to, you know, 50, but the 50 is a big number,
yeah,
regardless.
No, it's, yeah, it's, yeah, historically unprecedented in the country. Sure.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean, any evidence regarding this as a revenge factor?
Yeah, I don't, it depends what you would consider evidence. He obviously, you know, hates the teachers union.
Sure.
But I think there were other reasons beyond that, you know, and there is a very real budget crisis in the schools. So, you know, there are reasons beyond the teachers union that would be valid reasons to do something. And it's more, you know, what he decided to do and how many. And also the logic of doing them all at once, this wouldn't be so much to do with the teachers union, but it would be indirectly, you know, he wanted to like rip off the Band-Aid so people would have maybe gotten over their anger by the next election.
Yeah, you know, I could buy that. Mm-hmm. But the problem there is that the doing them all at once is people are going to point to that. That's not going to be something that people are going to forget. Yeah. And so it could be that, they might forget, but they might not. And especially where, for a lot of communities, especially where it seems like that the closings were concentrated in poorer and communities of color in the city, and less so in more affluent and whiter communities, for lack of a better word. That seems to bear true as far as you know?
Oh, positively. I mean, yeah, the maps and the analysis are all out there. Although there's an interesting side note to that. So yes, the great majority of them are in communities of color and really, black communities more so than Latino communities. A lot of the Latino schools got saved. They were on sort of the original list and then they got saved. And I think that has partly to do with the relative power of the Latino alderman versus the black alderman.
Sure.
But anyway, one interesting side note is that not so much closed. There were a handful of, schools closed in more white North Side neighborhoods. But what came after the school closings was massive budget cuts to the remaining schools. And some of the, best achieving, best funded schools with the largest white and wealthier populations did suffer massive budget cuts. And that actually mobilized opposition from a whiter and better off demographic that hadn't been so opposed or vocally opposed to the mayor before. So that's been an interesting, in the past, 6 months, angle.
Totally. I'd like to go back a moment to regarding Rahm Emanuel's time in the White House and chief of staff. Mm-hmm. So he was chief of staff. In fact, the headline in Chicago Indy Media was warmongering anti-immigrant NAFTA pusher named White House chief of staff. And to which, and local guy is now the chief of staff of the most powerful, right-hand man, basically, in the White House. So I'm wondering, and I don't know if there's any evidence about this, you talk about this some in the book, regarding the influence it seems like he had regarding shaping what could be a more progressive Obama administration in the White House into a less progressive direction. The example regarding healthcare is the one that, at least in my mind, and a lot of people probably as well, bring to mind. That it seems like that where they were able to push through a national healthcare law, which is no mean feat and is going to help a lot of people to some extent. And that's all to the good. The thing is that, especially where in Obama's earlier campaigns, he had talked about the distant dream of a lot of people, but which is reality in every other industrialized country, a single-payer Medicare for all system in the United States, which he actually campaigned on when he was in the state Senate. This is Obama now. And then the thing is, he's now in the White House. He's got the most powerful and visible political office in the world. He could, if not push for that, given the opposition of the lobby that might oppose him, he could at least push for something as close to it as he think he realistically could get. The example of a public public option was mentioned and touted as something he might be able to fight for and maybe even get. Who knows? And then it seems like that there were hints that, from what I could tell, that Rahm Emanuel, while in the White House, was trying to neuter that, saying, no, you want to do it in a little bit more of a corporatist fashion. I wouldn't say it like that, but that's basically what the direction of the policies would shape to. How much of an influence did Rahm Emanuel have while in as chief of staff into the direction that the White House could have in policy? What can you say about that?
Yeah, well, and this, of course, is just from reading different, kind of semi-insider accounts, books and blogs and things, because I have no, personal inside track there. But but you do read a lot that he had a ton of influence, more than your typical chief of staff. And even personality-wise, there's definitely, a number of journalists who've reported that the way his and Obama's, President Obama's personalities interacted, that Emanuel was kind of a bully even to Obama, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
And that he, really did sort of pressure and force Obama, or maybe not force, but, strongly pressure Obama to do things that were differently than he would have if he had a different chief of staff. And healthcare is, one of those examples you hear, and you also hear that, this is where, I don't think Rahm Emanuel is necessarily against everyone having healthcare. I mean, his father is a pediatrician, and, he probably would be happy if everyone had quality healthcare, but he's this ultimate political animal, and mm-hmm. he probably did believe that he couldn't get through, you know, that they needed to really scale back. And I guess he clashed even with his own brother on this. His brother right. wanted, you know, a more, much wider healthcare reform. So, and this is just a side note. People talk about Rahm Emanuel being so tough and so brave and just, you know, the ultimate political tough guy. But in a way, he was really sort of cautious and didn't take bold moves or bold stands in terms of, you know, not being willing to try for bolder healthcare reform. And at least two other issues off the top of my head were the climate bill and yeah. immigration. You know, yes. he was quoted saying immigration was the third rail that shouldn't be touched, even after Obama had indicated that he would tackle immigration. And then there's accounts that he also dissuaded Obama from a climate bill that would have limited carbon emissions.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was the cautious and maybe the politically smart thing to do, especially maybe in terms of immigration. But, you know, it was also, in a sense, you could almost say cowardly or just lacking like real boldness to, you know, the most popular at the time, man in the world, if he couldn't do it, who could? So,
and that kind of leads to me to thinking about another aspect regarding Rahm Emanuel, that while he's got this image about being this tough guy who won't say no and who swears so much that sailors walk by in shock and who mm-hmm. will fight even like relatively petty political points or the biggest issues of the day. But nonetheless, in some ways, he's also, I found, at least for me personally, kind of brittle. I'll actually mention a quick story. On the weekend that the NATO summit was taking place in Illinois in 2012, in Chicago, in fact, I and my family happened to attend the Montrose Kite Festival. And guess who shows up? Rahm Emanuel, with like an entourage of like 30 media and security, and like everyone there is just like, oh my God, there's the mayor, and they're like, you know, and he's shaking hands with people and kissing babies and doing all the kind of political things, and it actually came my way, and I actually had a video camera with me, and I'm like, and you know, my now wife actually shakes his hand, and I think he tried to motion to shake my hand, but I wouldn't, but okay. In the middle of this, and this is right in the middle of, there's a protest going on outside his house, maybe a mile away. Two protesters, come from that and meet him there and are speaking their mind loudly. The main concern they were complaining was with regards to the recent mental health care closures that Rahm Emanuel apparently had spearheaded, or at least the city had approved, and you know, six healthcare clinics, mental health care clinics were closed. So they were like complaining to him. Almost immediately after this, and with just two people on his tail, he up and leaves. The entire entourage goes up and walks. He goes to the limo and a police escort, and they get in and they speed out of sight. And then it's kind of considered safe. But he didn't respond to them. He didn't acknowledge their concerns. He didn't feel like he wanted to fight. Where he thought, like, okay, you know, you're Mr. Tough Guy, and you can take on even the most entrenched interests and the biggest issues of the day, and you never lose or very rarely lose. And yet here are two people who clearly don't have nearly a fraction of the clout or influence you do. And you're walking away like you don't want to, like you're being outmatched almost. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about this, is I found him to be very brittle. Especially when he's faced, and you talk about this in the book especially, the story of the, you have to forgive me, there was one woman.
Yeah, Helen Morley.
Thank you,
yeah.
Helen Morley. Tell me about Helen Morley.
Right, so what you said, and I think I've seen that video from the Kite Festival, so mm-hmm. I mean, that's
a perfect.
We posted
it on YouTube, so
yeah,
there you
right,
go.
Right. That's a great description, and the people in the mental health movement have brought that up time and again, and you know, other people too. But they really do make it a point to sort of follow him and, you know, show up as often as they can where he's appearing. And he does, they joke about how he seems to always just make a run for it when he's facing opposition or, you know, even. So anyway, Helen Morley was a woman with the mental health movement, with lifelong, pretty serious mental health problems and lived in public housing and, you know, had a lot of health problems, cardiac and other. So, and, you know, very low income, but she was just a born activist, and she would show up and, you know, do whatever she could on housing and mental health and all different issues. But she was really reliant on this mental health city, public mental health clinic that she attended. And she had a really strong relationship with her therapist there and with the other clients there. And she literally needed that in her mind. And it sort of ended up being true. She needed that base of support literally to survive. And that was one of the clinics that was closed. And when it was announced that it would be closed, she at least several times at City Hall and then at this birthday party for Chicago, mm-hmm. the 175th birthday party where she confronted the mayor, she made it a point to tell him, if you close my clinic, I will die. That was her exact words, kind of like a mantra, because she said it so often. And it was not even in, it wasn't even like a strategic political slogan or even, you know, the kind of message that like a nonprofit or a union would come up with after strategizing.
Sure.
It was literally the off the top of her head, from her heart, you know, what she felt.
It's her life.
Yeah. And so at this birthday party, the mayor was there, you know, celebrating and shaking hands and stuff. And she made her way through the crowd saying, you know, please listen to me. If you close my clinic, I'm going to die. And she was literally saying, please, Mayor Emanuel, you know, even giving him the respectful, you know, title of Mayor Emanuel, listen to me. And he didn't even make eye contact with her. You know, he literally did make a run for it out the door and cut the event short. And then she actually did die of a heart attack. But everyone that knows her thinks it was the stress of the clinic closing. So,
but he's just so afraid to confront, I mean, just even one or two people with a message.
It's true. Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, it kind of speaks to a kind of cowardice almost. Mm. But also, I mean, in some ways, I think it also kind of speaks to the power about just like, it's not the kind of thing that you could buy with $1 million. Mm. It's the kind of thing where it's like, you can't buy that kind of passion or interest. Mm. You can only, you know, try to cultivate it from other sources. In this case, in the case of Helen Morley, it was literally her life.
Yeah.
She was going to die. Sad to say she did. But, you know, you tell her story in the book. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the mental health movement, I don't know. The research about this might be too soon to tell. But it seems like, and there was a study about this in Kansas that was actually just released last year, where there were apparently researchers in Kansas discovered a connection between the lack of spending and the closures of mental health clinics in Kansas with a rise in suicides in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And they figured, and at least the assessment seems to be, that they're connected. Mm-hmm. Do you know about whatever it's probably too soon to tell, but what are the negative impacts so far regarding those mental health closures? Is there any evidence of that yet so far besides Helen Morley and others?
Right. Well, right shortly after the closings, I forget what month it is, what was, but it was really shortly after the closings, the union AFSCME that represents the clinic workers, mm-hmm. along with the mental health movement, actually did document, I think it was, they did document some real effects. I think it was hospitalizations of the mental health clinic clients, if I'm remembering right.
Mm-hmm.
And those numbers did actually go up almost immediately after the clinics closed. I'm not sure if there, well, I don't think there has been, more hard evidence since then, but part of the reason these groups have been, AFSCME, the union, did document that somewhere between 500 and 2000, specific people just dropped off the city's radar screen in the time the clinics were closed, in the city. And this was really evident with the public housing in Chicago. Also, this was before Emanuel's time, but it's a parallel situation. The city did a really bad job of keeping track of where people went after the clinics closed. And I don't know if there's been any statistical evidence that emergency room visits have gone up in terms of the mental health clients, but I don't think anyone would dispute that when you get rid of mental health care or really any kind of affordable, accessible care, that emergency room visits and also incarcerations go up. And the county sheriff was really opposed to closing the mental health clinics because he knew that he would be one of the people picking up the slack.
there's, I think, a little bit of a connection there with Rahm Emanuel even before he was mayor, because he was on the board of the Chicago Housing Authority.
That's true, right.
And he was part of the vaunted plan for transformation,
right.
Which basically closed a lot of public housing and probably sent a lot of people out into the streets and out in ways that a lot of people couldn't reasonably document. Mm-hmm. And maybe some have died because, you know, no one can track them, mm-hmm. and they don't have a house. You have a chapter. It's about budget. And especially where it's not the kind of thing that I think is going to be deemed a kind of terribly sexy topic, but it's an important one, and you talk about it here. But here's the thing about budget that I think is kind of, you talk about some. It seems like the rationale that's always posed regarding the kind of privatization and outsourcing to the public, to the private sector, regarding a lot of public service jobs, things like, you know, janitorial work and so forth, and maybe collecting the garbage. It seems like the rationale that's always mentioned is it's always cost effective. You know, these corporations are in the free market, and they got to compete for jobs, and that makes them lean and mean and efficient, and therefore they can do a better job at a lower price, and isn't that awesome? And yet, when contracts are handed off to one or another privatized firm, it turns out that no, they don't do as good a job, and they wind up costing more anyway. Tell us more about that, and why, if it seems like that kind of puts the light of the fact that they're cheaper and more efficient, why privatize if they're seeing that's the evidence, if that's the reason for it? I mean, clearly the evidence doesn't show it.
Right.
Talk about that, please.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason that, like, it may be, it actually, I think, you know, a lot of times is the case that a private company can offer a lower bid than, like, say, the union representing the public workers can put forward to do a different type of job. But those bids don't usually include a lot of pretty direct, we're not even talking indirect, but pretty direct costs. So an example would be, there was a big sort of battle over who would do the recycling, private mm-hmm. or public employees. And the unions were pointing out that the private contractors would keep the recyclables and they would get the profit from it. Whereas if the city did it, the city would get, you know, the profit from selling the recyclables. And then even just things where especially if the city has a strong public sector, you get efficiencies, like, again, with kind of the garbage collection. You know, the city garbage trucks can also be involved in snow removal and rodent control. That's stuff the union was bringing up.
Mm-hmm.
And, private contractors they're not going to just, to be nice, do some extra jobs. Like, if it's a light garbage day or whatever, they're
right.
not going to go out and plow some snow for you.
Right.
So, you know, you can't have that flexibility you would have if you keep things public. But then probably one of the most important things is that city employees have to live in the city, and private contractors don't have to live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to create, you know, if you want to keep that, those incomes circulating in the city, those paychecks circulating in the city, it really makes sense to have public employees, because then their paychecks, you know, and a lot of them are, you know, either lower or middle income jobs. So they're spending that money. They're not just putting it in their bank account. And then one thing worth mentioning is in some cases, you know, the city talked about this all being for efficiency and reducing the deficit. But in a couple, at least several cases, the unions actually did promise to do the work more cheaply than a private company, and they were just kind of ignored. Like, they weren't taken up on that promise, and the jobs were privatized anyway, which just gets to the fact that on some level the mayor really wants to curb the power or, you know, bust the public unions.
A more specific mundane question related to the book. Has you had mentioned in the book that Mayor Emanuel declined an interview request when you were asked him to be interviewed mm-hmm. for the book. Since the book has been published, has he made any announcement or statement regarding it? Or has
no,
he just dismissed it all?
I haven't heard anything
okay.
from his office at all.
Has, and speaking more about the mayor issues, Chicago is the largest city in the United States without mayoral term limits.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that, as was the case with other mayors before, Rahm Emanuel could be mayor for a very, very long time. And he's only been mayor, assuming that's the case, just a shade over 2 years now. And you know, you've been able to fill a book with, you know, just 2 years of exploits. Obviously, there's more of his career, but a lot of this is about Chicago. In about a year, I think the elections are in February 2015, he would be up for election. The longstanding chant is, at least in protests that I've known and seen and heard and even attended, one-term mayor. And yet, he's got, it was announced, I read it in the Chicago Sun-Times, a $5 million war chest, mm-hmm. which is as much as he had raised to get elected. He now has more than a year and a half out of the elections, with very likely the chance to raise more. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's, you might be deemed to be a realistic shot of trying to win the mayor's race in Chicago would, in all likelihood, have to match or exceed that. And unless you're Donald Trump, chances are that you're not going to have the money to be able to pull that off. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about his, it seems like it's not so much the prospects about whether or not he wants to be mayor or has the muscle to be able to pull it off. Clearly the answers, I think, to both of those are yes. Mm-hmm. But do you think that anyone could realistically oust him, given the kind of bad image in the public sphere that he has?
Well, I mean, I would hate to say never, but I think any realistic evidence and predictions would say in this next race, probably not. You know, surprises can happen, and there's definitely a lot of, discontent and creative organizing going on, but it's highly, highly unlikely for this next election. I think the question would be, does he decide to seek a third term? And if he does, you know, by
a
that
third
time.
Term.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, they're just thinking ahead.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? By that time, maybe things will have changed, and there could be a more powerful opposition candidate.
Do you see anyone? Who do you foresee as possible candidates in 2015?
It sounds pretty clear that Toni Preckwinkle from the county is not going to run.
Right.
So, I mean, she would have been.
She might have been maybe the best chance.
Right. Yeah, yeah. But so she's not. The aldermen, Bob Fioretti and Scott Wigspack, have sort of indicated interest. And, you know, a lot of, they would probably have huge support among critics of the mayor and, you know, among a pretty broad swath of the public, but just the money, if nothing else, would just be so difficult. So, you know, it's, I think if they run, it would probably be to make a statement and, you know, maybe to help lay the groundwork for at least maybe a future run, or maybe just to at least send the mayor a message that he's not he doesn't have complete power and consensus.
Sure. About Rahm Emanuel generally, it seems like that the reputation, I don't know if there's actually any statement about this, but it seems like that the mayor, winning the mayor's race in Chicago was kind of like for lack of a better word, a booby prize. It was not the kind of thing that I think he really wanted. It seemed like, especially where he was in, you know, he was high up in the DCCC. He was maybe, and certainly it was a mover and shaker in Congress. I could see him trying to vie for maybe Speaker of the House, or Lord knows, maybe even trying to, you know, Senate race, or maybe even the president one day. I could see him trying to go for that. And it seems like that, just given the fact that he was kind of tapped for the White House and didn't really see an easy way to get back into that kind of Congress, that it seems like that, it's like, okay, I'll be mayor. So it seems like to me that he might actually see of himself, despite the power he wields in this city and in, as mayors generally, something of a disappointment. I don't know if you want to try to play mind reader here, but do you think that's how he would see himself?
No, I mean, this is total, absolute speculation, but I think he probably thought it would just be a cakewalk and he could just come in and have fun and, you know, implement all these great things and clean up the city's problems and, reward some of his friends with positions and contracts and things. I thought he probably thought he was going to have a great time, and I think he's definitely been surprised at how difficult it actually is. And it also, I mean, around the time, even before he came mayor, was when there was sort of this trend of like these rock star mayors like Villaraigosa in LA.
Right.
And so, you know, in Bloomberg. And so I think being mayor of a big city had become a more attractive thing in the last, 10 years or so. So I think he was probably excited about it.
The one statement I've seen him make with regards to whether or not he's going to try to shoot for higher office, in quotes, whatever that might mean, you know, governor or senate or president, he said no. Do you think that, you think he's going to probably stick to that? Do you think he's going to be mayor for life, or do you think he might shoot for another office someday?
I bet he'd shoot for another office. I mean, people, you know, Hillary Clinton said she's not running for president. I mean, people say, and politicians obviously deny that they're going to run for something all the time. So, I mean, he's someone obviously with limitless ambition, mm-hmm. and being mayor of Chicago obviously isn't the most powerful position in the country. So I think it's a given he's going to aim higher. It just depends when and where exactly.
It might be Senate. It might be presidency, although I don't know if I think his name, especially with the CTU strike, I doubt he'll ever become president. We saw Rudy Giuliani vie for and crash badly as far as vying for the Republican presidential bid.
Right.
Do you think you could see him doing that? He might try to vie for a Democratic presidential bid someday, and maybe not in 2016,
oh,
but maybe in like,
yeah.
I don't know, that'd be 2024, I suppose.
Yeah,
would that
be a possibility? I mean, I know people were talking about that. You know, someone, I think it might have been NBC Wardroom, Ted McClelland, I think was him, or someone had a good line about how you see every time Emmanuel has a big announcement, it's in, you know, national media. Mm-hmm. And he, something about, you know, that laying the ground. Anyway, I don't remember the quote, but it was
right.
Better than that.
Sure.
But yeah, I think, I mean, I think that speculation's died down because it's obvious he's not going to do it in 2016, and going from mayor to the White House to be president would be pretty unusual. But, I think, and by the time he runs for mayor, I think the CTU strike will be, you know, far in the past. I think there'll be a lot more time for him to, you know, for better or worse, have other controversies
yeah.
attached to his
no,
name.
I was just thinking, it's like, okay, worse things are going to probably happen in his view, basically.
Yeah, and you know, his attack on unions, just one note on that. I mean, if he were to run for president right now, his weakness would probably not be so much that. It would be that on gay rights and things, he's actually too liberal, and
right.
you know, being Jewish, it's the country might not be ready for that. So I think if anything, these attacks on unions might be something he's doing intentionally to win over you know, anti-union people for future national ambitions.
And even if he doesn't get to higher office, what of Rahm Emanuel's final legacy? And I guess we'll end the interview with this. In just 2 years' time, although this might be an exaggeration, a lot of people might say that in just 2 years he might already count himself as among the worst mayors in Chicago history. And that's probably no small mean feat. Do you think that's hyperbole, or do you think there's something to it? Or what would be the... Is there any sense about what might be the final political obituary of Rahm Emanuel when it's all said and done? Any sense there, or is it too soon to tell?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely too soon, but I'll give a thought anyway. I think worst is just way too vague and subjective a term, but I think he will definitely be seen as someone who changed Chicago, and the way he changed it remains to be seen. But, you know, a lot of people feel like, I mean, he is changing Chicago in some good ways in
right.
terms of just a lot of innovation and clean energy and technology and, you know, making the downtown even nicer and more livable than under Daley. But a lot of people at the same time feel like they're being, I mean, with the school closings, you know, just like they're being cut out of the city's future and they're just being ignored. So, you know, and then there's also this, you know, still in the relatively early stages, but this galvanizing of popular resistance. So he's definitely changing the face of Chicago in some form that will be lasting, and how that really, what that is, remains to be seen.
That's the one silver lining I see, is that he, probably unlike any other mayor in recent vintage, at least in Chicago, has been a kind of great unifier. A lot of people who would normally squabble among themselves have found a common enemy in Rahm Emanuel, and that hopefully can, at least in my opinion, help to build those alliances that ultimately themselves will win changes down the road. So if there's any positive sense to a jerk like Rahm Emanuel being mayor, not to inject any bias into the interview, I think that might be the lasting legacy he has. We've been speaking with Kari Leiterson. She is a Chicago-based journalist who had worked with the Washington Post and with the Chicago News Cooperative, who works on energy, environment, labor, and immigration issues, the author of a number of books. And we've been speaking about her most recent book, Mayor 1%, Rahm Emanuel and the Rise of Chicago's 99%, published by Haymarket Books. Kari, thank you.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Chicago journalist Kari Leiterson, author of the new book, Mayor 1%. Rahm Emanuel and the Rise of Chicago's 99%. Kari Leiterson's website is karileiterson.com, spelled KARILYDERSEN.com. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Bree Hayden. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode, From the Trenches.